Okay, then we're going to proceed with goodwill and impairment.
Thanks, Hans. So, good morning. So the staff are set out in papers 18A and for disclosure 18B for further work, the further work that we think the board could consider performing before the board decides on the possible solutions to be set out in a discussion paper. And paper 18C provides an outline of the possible structure of that discussion paper. So we'd like to take paper 18A first. So as a result of the change in focus of the project, now exploring improving the disclosures about business combinations, simplifying the accounting for goodwill, and making some targeted changes to value in use calculation in the impairment test, the staff have reviewed previous decisions made by the board to identify whether any of those decisions could be reconsidered in the light of the change in focus of the project. And these are shown in the table at paragraph 11B. Paragraphs 13 to 27 outline the staff's thoughts on the additional work that would be performed on these ideas if the board agreed to reconsider them, and also the work that would be performed on the ideas that the board, in its July meeting, asked the staff to explore, and also those ideas where the staff think no further work is required before the board decides whether these ideas should be supported in the discussion paper. The staff would then present the results of the additional work performed and present a package of those ideas for the board to consider with analysis of how those ideas meet the objectives set by the board in July. And so I'd like to open up the discussion now. And there's two questions in the paper. Firstly, does the board agree with the additional work set out in the paper and the ideas to reconsider? And secondly, does the board have any further suggestions for additional work for the staff to perform? And just to be clear, we're not asking the board whether they support the ideas being discussed today. It's just whether they would like the staff to perform further work and consider these when proposing possible solutions to the board at a subsequent meeting. So I'll open the discussion up now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hans. First, with regard to paragraph 15, the staff think that whether the board could consider providing guidance on the differences between the two methods, that is value in use and very less cost of disposal. I'm not very clear why we need to provide guidance on the differences between two methods. What's our objective to do this kind of guidance? Yeah.
So I think it's certainly feedback that we'd actually heard in the ASAP meeting in October, and it's feedback that we've had during the project as well. To provide some guidance around what the difference between the two methods are, particularly if we're starting to eliminate, in terms of those improvements, targeted improvements to value in use, about the inclusion of cash flows, enhancement cash flows, and the use of discount rates, the differences between the two methods start to become lesser and lesser, and it's to provide some guidance to practitioners to enable them to understand what those differences are and hopefully help improve the process of impairment testing through that.
Maybe I could add a bit of colour to that. From some of the outreach meetings I went to with some of the audit firms, a message we got from some of them, although not consistently from all of them, was that they find it more difficult to challenge the assumption and estimates that go into value in use. We found that quite surprising because when they described some of the things, we wondered how people would think that some of the assumptions were reasonable. But it may be there's some case for adding a bit more guidance to confirm that value in use is largely like fair value, but with an entity-specific focus, but you can't just make it up. It's got to be based on something.
Yes, I think if the objective we try to eliminate those differences and to adopt one method, it's unsustainable. But if we try to provide guidance on the differences between two methods, it seems it's not understandable, because currently fair value less cost and disposal, we already have IFRS 13 to provide a guidance with regard to how to determine the fair value. So if we would like to provide a guidance with value in use, we only can provide guidance on value use, not the difference between two methods. Yeah.
Sorry, if I can make one other comment as well, which I forgot to make then. I think one other thing has changed since this guidance was issued, which is we've issued the conceptual framework. And we have actually got some discussion in the conceptual framework of the difference between entity-specific measurements and market participant measurements. And so it might be that there's something we could build on there.
Nick? Thank you. We'll try and avoid the temptation to discuss the merits of the individual ideas that the staff has set out, although some of them I care about strongly. But I think given that the overall objective of the project has been modified, that it's right to step back and reconsider and to think pragmatically in terms of where we could consider ideas that have previously been rejected under a previous objective. I like the way how you've set out that where clearly there is no need for further work on some of those, and where some of them do require further work. So I think it's a very pragmatic approach. I think it's right that we do step back and reassess.
So, I just wanted to check my understanding. So on in section D of 12 or, and in 13A, where we talk about the proposal to remove the restriction that excludes particular cash flows from the calculation of value and use to try and get a better alignment between that and the fair value measurement. As you might remember, I'm fine with that in theory, but I did have a few reservations in terms of, you know, how much discipline we might need around that. So we say when we've done enough to sort of proceed without doing any further work, makes me, won't be surprised, a little bit nervous. But in the discussion paper, will we at least flag the fact that what are we thinking we're going to say in terms of any sort of restrictions or controls around the basis for the numbers that go in there?
So I think
we've done work to support that.
So I think as part of one of the previous papers discussing this particular topic, there was some thoughts around some potential language that could be put in around management intention and how forecasts are used for the basis of value in use, for example, and some guidance on the thoughts around how those forecasts should be developed and the supportability of those forecasts. And so I think we would build on that within the discussion paper.
So we'd be at least flagging some of the things we'd be wanting to think about.
Yes.
As a basis for any further discussion subsequently. Yes. Thank you.
Doug.
Thank you. I have a concern with the timeline. The discussion paper is, you know, expected to be issued in the first half year of 2020. So it's nearly 2 years' time. So it's way too long to prepare. And I do understand some of the preparation additional for the additional work, but actually there are lots of discussion we have already made. So it could be somehow the repetition of the discussion. So I strongly have a strong concern with discussion fatigue, repeating the same thing. And you said we are going to consult with CMAQ-GPF. The CMAQ-GPF meeting will be held in the next March. We will have it in November, however, it's too short. So we need to wait until March. But I don't think we have to wait until March, because we can do the more separate one-on-one outreach. It's possible. We don't really have to wait. And then with respect to the value in use and the fair value. I couldn't agree more what Jin Chao said. Actually, we have discussed it many times, and discussing it again doesn't really provide a benefit for us. And I do understand what Peter said. There are some needs for guidance, but we could do it by not within the DP project, but we could provide some educational material. And I personally disagree with to adopt a single method. It doesn't provide enough benefit for both users and preparers. That's what we have concluded in the past. And one other very important point is interaction with the US GAAP. Actually, FASB has started the discussion of subsequent accounting of goodwill. And there is a possibility that they may come to the conclusion much quicker than us. So that gives me other concerns. So if we take nearly 2 years, so then FASB made a conclusion and finalized it. So it will give us strong constraint to our discussion. So we need to monitor what the progress of the US GAAP discussion and keep contacting with FASB staff is really important. And sometimes we need to speed up our discussion. And having said that, some of the additional work is necessary, especially for simplification. And in the discussion with World Standard Setters Meeting breakout session, some people said in reintroduction of amortization does not contribute to the simplification because impairment test still remains. So if we were to reintroduce amortization, we'd need to consider a little more drastic simplification to impairment test. And I take some points for such a discussion. So therefore, additional work for considering entity level impairment or segment level impairment may be necessary.
I share a lot of what Zach has said. I think we should really aim at having a document that is a good support for an effective consultation, so that indeed a number of possible decisions, solutions are explored and analyzed. We have a lot of elements already. I agree that the change in objectives may have an effect on what the conclusion could be. But frankly, when I look at the timetable, eventually more than half of us will be gone for the next round of decision making. So really, what is the relevance of preliminary views? We really can have a good discussion paper with some, that would mention that eventually following a different objective, the board had a preliminary view, if that has to be mentioned, but having an analysis provided by the staff in a discussion paper stating how the change in objective may have an effect. And then seek the views of people. It's not as if we were in an area where nobody has knowledge, that we are considering things which are really completely new. In fact, we are we have already discussed and rediscussed things that are known and people have already ideas. So I think there would be much more benefit in attempting at really issuing an effective consultation document, not looking for a masterpiece, yes, and making sure that we don't raise issues again that are not needed. So when I look at what your proposals are, I can't see why there would be benefit revisiting what is in paragraph 15. So especially, I'm not sure that the change in objective has anything to do with this issue anyway. On the further simplification of the impairment test, I think those issues have already been debated, so they enter in the scope that I've described. I think we need to do some work on amortization because we had discarded that, so, and there would be very there are a number of issues to consider there. I also support item E, so see whether there are implications for the presentation disclosure of goodwill. And for item D, which is seeking feedback from investors on what the carrying amount of goodwill is used for, I think we already have some of that. If we have a round of discussions with investors when we do some further work on disclosures, if we do that, then, I mean, it doesn't harm to have a supplementary question, but I would not go for a distinct round on this issue, and just for the sake of that issue.
Yeah. I must say that I agree with a lot of Hans-Rijs and Tucker said. This is, after all, it is going to be a discussion paper. There will be a lot of outreach after the issuance of the discussion paper. We already know a lot. Also, it is not, you only get really clear answers from your constituents once you have put things clearly on paper. And then they can agree or disagree. So I would like the staff to rethink. I mean, the issues are fine, but rethink the method and try to gain some time here, because otherwise it's just going to take forever and ever. And if necessary, look at staffing, but this is an important issue debated. And I'm not so worried about the FSB taking decisions very soon. But they are looking at it as well. But I'm not so much worried that they will decide tomorrow to completely change the accounting for goodwill subsequent accounting. If we can look creatively at trying to gain some time, I think that would be very good. Anne?
Prior to the people speaking, I also held the view that I was very concerned about the timeline. I think a lot of the work has been done. So in terms of question one, I would support action on B, which was simplification, trying to find what we know on that and be very careful about what further work we need to do. And E, which is disclosure, and we'll touch on that in the second paper as well. I was very reluctant to do further work on amortization. The thing that's changed is that the FASB are looking at it. We have done enormous amounts of work over several years, and I believe that we need to just go back to that work and collect up that work, because I don't believe things have changed in terms of what we know from our stakeholders. There are polarised views on this topic. That's not going to have changed. The academic evidence is stable on this topic. So I would prefer that we just found what we've got already and presented it in the light of our revised objective, and then didn't spend more time on it.
Gary?
Thank you. Yeah, I'll begin by agreeing with much of what Taka and Francois said, but I think, Tim, looking at the extra work you're going to do, which in general we support pretty much all of it in all the papers, I'm going to suggest, I mean, these are written as isolated questions. I think the feedback has to come back a little bit more holistically. Let me give you an example. We've always heard about the difficulties and what's the effective life for goodwill amortization. And that's difficult to verify, difficult to get. But at the same time, the cash flow projections for the impairment test are difficult to get also. Is one more difficult to do than the other? And we've been plugging this thing all the time I've been here, but I think we got to start bringing this is difficult, that's difficult, and put them together and say which is more difficult or whatever, because I think they're hard to assess in the vacuum. And likewise, we talk about, one of the reasons why the headroom approach is supportive. The argument is, well, it provides information about how the acquisition is doing. even though I have my somewhat doubts on that, I'll accept the premise as stated. But likewise, and it comes up in paper 18B, the disclosures of how an acquisition is due in the early years, does that solve the same information problem? So I think we need to start putting these things together. They're trade-offs, is what they are. And there's pros and cons and ease and difficulties in both of them. I think they need to come back together as a unit. Coming up with amortization lives is a whole lot easier, quite frankly, than it is to do extended cash flow projections out in perpetuity. And I think slightly different thing. I think there's a consequence if we stayed with an impairment model is one, I think the consequence is in time, all goodwill will be impaired. It has to be. It has to go away sometime. And if I'm wrong on that, you can take it offline, but I think it exists forever, which nothing exists forever, or it gets impaired. And do you ever get to the point where, yeah, I do have goodwill, but I can see the end of life coming in some years out on whatever asset or acquisition or business activity that goodwill is associated with, and you, in effect, at any one point in time, you've got small impairments kind of approaching the effect of amortization. You know, if you've got 5 years left, every year you write off 20% of the goodwill because you've got 20% less operating assets to throw off money toward it. So I think we need to kind of, what is the implications of that long term? Everything's impaired. That's the implication. Or it lasts forever, and I don't agree with that.
Chen Wu.
Thank you. Generally agree with your suggestions, recommendations, but I'd like to say something on that issue Jinjiao raised on paragraph 15. The guidance on the difference between VIU and fair value LCD. I feel, you know, more stronger requirement on the maybe difference between these two, VIU and the fair value LCD, just to give a kind of guidance. That will make our entities to get some kind of discipline when they use VIU rather than fair value LCD. Because many people are saying, fair value LCD is a proper number because that's based on the market-based perspectives assumptions. But VIU is a kind of an entity-specific perspective. So many people are wondering what these numbers mean, really. So based on the current requirement in IAS 36, there is very minimum requirement on VIU. But in the case of fair value LCD, there are many requirements in IAS 36. But only one paragraph is, just one simple paragraph is required in now IAS 36, even though this VIU is the most popular measurement way to measure recoverable amount. Most of companies using the VIU, but disclosure requirements are so weak. Even though we have some kind of a feedback from the PIR, this VIU is a kind of a problem to make our carrying amount of goodwill on the balance sheet for many, many years. So that's why I'm thinking if we, even though we stopped the discussion of the hedge approach temporarily, we shouldn't give up the kind of a big objective to fix to late problem. Still, that's, I guess, the most important problem. Many people are worrying about the big, huge amount of a goodwill on the balance sheet for very, very long time. So we need to tackle with this issue. You know, we shouldn't do, I guess, you know, the additional disclosure is not enough because that's not influenced any amount of the balance sheet. So that's not so effective. So I'm saying we need to keep some further work on how to, you know, make this a carrying amount of goodwill on balance sheet. You know, that's the, I guess that's the main issue. Another thing is in paragraph 15, and the first sentence, you said this kind of amendment would reduce the difference between their VIU and fair value LCD. But theoretically, it's correct. But practically, I'm expecting the opposite effect. The practical amounts that the entities will calculate will be larger and larger after this amendment. So LCD, fair value LCDs are staying the same amount. However, VIU will be getting bigger. So that means we are giving a kind of more flexibility, even though the model is getting not closer to each other. So there is some kind of reduction between these two models, but the outcome of the effect is giving a more opportunity for entities to get these carrying amounts of goodwill on the balance sheet for longer and longer years. So that's what I'm saying. We need a more stronger requirement if we don't introduce headroom approach. So this is the one of these two amounts to test to get a kind of impairment or not. This VIU recoverable amount is one of these two. So we failed to improve the headroom approach when calculate something here. That's one side. But if you can do something, to this VIU calculation, more properly, then we can achieve that the primary objective of this project. That's what I'm saying.
Mary?
I'm going to start with an apology, which is I think the staff may be feeling a bit of the board's frustration. Certainly, I'm worried that what I'm going to say is my frustration that we've been dealing with this for so long and we're still, kind of struggling. So please don't take this personally. I think you've been handed a bit of a hot potato to try and sort out. And then when I step back, so I'm saying the comments I'm making are against the background of being skeptical about doing lots more work before we try and pull together the package. So sharing some of the other concerns you've heard. When I think about what we want to accomplish with a discussion paper, I think particularly in this case, and I'm drawing on some of the experiences we've had with the outreach we're doing right now on financial instruments with characteristics of equity and our discussion paper there, I think we will get the best feedback if we're asking the question of, is there an accounting question that we should be trying to solve? We had the PIR, we had feedback in the PIR. As I think Anne said, a lot of the views, were rerun of what the board had heard when IFRS 3 itself was updated. So I think having done a lot of work to try and follow up on things in the PIR, we have to reach a preliminary view of, should we be going ahead with standard setting? And if so, what is the objectives of standard setting? And what are the most, likely tools? And some of the work that is to build out more of the details, I don't think we need to do, the discussion paper and have a really focused discussion paper on what we think the problem is that we should be trying to solve and what are the things we're thinking that would be our way to solve it. I think we do have to have a view on those questions. Otherwise, we're kind of handing our stakeholders a menu and saying, please pick what you want, and we'll just have yet another round of debates of all the same issues. And I think we have to go out and say, having tried with one set of objectives, we made some decisions. We then decided we couldn't pursue those objectives. I think we should capture everything we've done, but I think we have to really distinguish what it is that we think we want to pursue and what problem we think it will solve, and then do provide all the other things because I think it's helpful, but I think we have to separate them so we don't make everybody recreate our journey in order to understand what it is we're suggesting we do. And I think that's important because when I was reading through 18A, I got lost between things where we wanted to do more work in order to form a preliminary view of not to do that, versus where we were doing more work because we thought we might want to propose it. Because, you know, the staff said very carefully that just because you're saying do more work doesn't mean that we're going to, you know, to recommend going that route. So I may be a bit different from Nick in terms of saying it's good that we that we're open to reconsidering decisions that we made in the context of different objectives. I think we do have to go back and look at those decisions and say which of those decisions were impacted by the are impacted by the change in objective. And some of them, I don't see how dropping the headroom approach, some of the ones that the staff recommends reconsidering, I don't see how the change in the objectives means that we have to reconsider them, because part of the frustration is we're redoing debates that were had in IFRS 3, and then we get more frustrated when we're redoing debates that we already did in the context of the follow-up to the PIR. So I kind of see a higher hurdle in terms of saying, here's how the changing context makes us need to redo this, as opposed to we've had a change in objective, so let's redo virtually all the conclusions. And then the last kind of general observation, just trying to track through what we decided in July. Paragraph, the question for the board on page 10 said, B is further simplifications of the impairment test. Now, when I look back at the beginning of the paper and the recap of the decisions we reached in July, I didn't see further simplifications of the impairment test as one of the objectives that we had decided in July. So if the staff is saying to us, I think we need to still have an objective of further simplifications, that's fine, but let's say that. And then in terms of the additional work, just ticking through them, I guess I have some skepticism about whether we need the guidance on differences between VIU and fair value in order to do a discussion paper. I wouldn't rule it out, but to me it's kind of dependent upon which path we're pursuing. And then in terms of conducting our own research, I do feel like we've done a lot of the work. I'm not sure that I think we need to go back to ASAF, CMAQ, or GPF in terms of input on the list in paragraph 22. Amortization, if we were to change the subsequent accounting. Because I think we have a lot of information about that, and B, I think we need to focus in the discussion paper on, where we should be going. I think we have to be able to enumerate these and maybe some initial thoughts, but I kind of feel like we have enough, and I wouldn't do a lot of the development now before we try to bring our stakeholders along with what set of problems we're trying to solve. So I don't know quite how I'd vote on the list of specifics in the question, but I do think we should have a high bar to redoing anything we've done in terms of getting to this point.
Cheryl?
One of the reasons why I think the staff may have been looking at a longer timeline, and I'm just interested in sort of getting an understanding of how you were seeing the split, was the idea that you were actually thinking that midway through next year we would do the split between exposure draft and discussion paper, and presumably an exposure draft would need to have all the solutions in place. I'm just wondering how big a deal were you thinking that an exposure draft might be, because obviously that does affect some of the discussion we've had around the table. Discussion paper would presumably be out a lot quicker, but an exposure draft...
We've decided to do a DP.
The question is open.
Question 30 actually says, at the same time, the board will also consider whether certain of the possible solutions would be included in exposure draft.
That's right. I think those are the two bits about VIU.
Right. Okay.
VIU.
Tom?
Oh, yes. I'm going to just make one small... Jin Chow's, I agree with Jin Chow's comment. It's not the difference. As I understand it, it's the VIU application. I hear that companies will actually say, this is our budget, and use that. And it could be an optimistic, or it could be a budget designed to provide incentives. And so we need to tidy the wording. I know I agree with Peter, the wording appears to be there, but appears to be ignored. So I just echoed on that one issue. on the other ones, I really like the idea of splitting the two in terms of getting to a solution, which we're coming to in B. So I'll just echo again. So this is setting goodwill aside from what you need to know about what's happening in an acquisition. So I think that's really good. And I think that might be, I want to just underline that, because I think that will drive the thinking in the discussion paper. If we keep those two tidy, then what's left over in goodwill? Because I think we've always had, in all those discussions about goodwill, we always had both issues kind of intermingled a little bit. I just think it may help our thinking, although I am conscious that there's probably a fair amount of fatigue in going back to the goodwill. I doubt there's as much fatigue if we explore how to do information about acquisitions.
True. Just one general observation triggered by something that Mary said. I think one of the things perhaps we, and I mean the staff, need to think about carefully is what we're envisaging this ultimate discussion paper might end up looking like, mm-hmm. and how detailed that should and needs to be to have an effective consultation. And the point that Mary made that made me think about it is the FICE discussion paper, because I think, and this is no criticism of the staff because the board signed off on it, but I think when I've done some of the outreach recently on the FICE document, I have been struck by the number of people who seem to be disengaged from the process by the complexity of the document and how big it is and how detailed it is. I think inadvertently there's an aspect where it creates a sort of a barrier to engagement, which is the opposite of what we intend. And so I think maybe we should think carefully about how detailed we really think a discussion paper needs to be effective, to really get the input that we need in this stage of the deliberations. And I think maybe that's because I think probably part of this timeline envisages quite a detailed, lengthy, thorough document, which takes a long time for us to produce, a long time to go through the balloting process, but then it takes a long time also for people to digest and react to. And if it's got stuff in there that people hate, we've spent a hell of a long time collectively in the system finding that information. And so I think we need to maybe be a bit creative in terms of what we think this document should be like that we put out at the end.
Yeah.
Maybe just a couple of comments on the sort of nature of the document. I mean, first of all, this is a very different animal from FICE, because a lot of the stuff in FICE is very new for people and its technical content as well. This, I think the danger is everybody already has an opinion on most of it. And if we just replay to people what they already know, we'll hear back what they already think and we won't really be any further forward. So I think it's a different kind of challenge, I think, for getting effective inputs. I think if it's open-ended, we're not going to get any useful input at all, because we will just hear what everybody thinks. So I think the board needs to have preliminary views in there. On these things. So, for example, on amortisation, the board reached a conclusion, but that's sort of back in play again now, but the board hasn't reached a conclusion, that's back in play. So I think we'll get more input if the board is at least giving a steer there and where it thinks the answer's going. Otherwise, I think we'll just get chaotic responses. And I don't necessarily agree that a longer document takes longer to write than a short document. I think a good short document can actually take a long time to write as well.
Yes, but it's usually more effective.
But I think what we maybe need to spend, and I agree with you, I think a lot of preparation time maybe for a shorter document, you're right, doesn't necessarily follow that because it's shorter, it's quicker. But I think what we need to put a lot of our energy into for this project is with the messaging around what it is we're trying to solve.
Yeah.
And what it is exactly that we want input on.
Yeah.
Because the challenge I've had, going back to FICE again, and Puma will kick me later, is that I've had to spend a lot of time in outreach re-explaining why the document's out there and what question we're really asking and why we really think we need to do the project, because people are losing sight of that when they get into the detail. And you're right, it's a different nature of subject matter, but I think it's the messaging is the key bit where I think we should put energy into.
I mean, another thing we can do, and I think it is important that we have a focused set of proposals that people can react to and not just replay what they already think. I think it's also important that we put out there what we've looked at, because there aren't easy answers. And I think we need to show people there aren't easy answers. We don't necessarily need to do it in the same document. I mean, we can have a focused document that contains what the board's talking about, and we can export some of the other thought process into a separate document.
Mary?
Peter, I agree that the consultation will be much more effective if we have preliminary views. But I think there's a difference between, it's first a question of preliminary views about what, and second, it's how much detail do you need to back that up? And I think this DP more than others makes me focus on the question of preliminary views about what. And I think it's things like, should we be trying, we've been trying for 4 years now to address some of the problems from the PIR. Has our work demonstrated to us that we're going to try, and the centerpiece of this response is disclosure with minor changes, or is it equivalent level of change on disclosure and accounting? I mean, I think that's the kind of thing. And use the DP to get buy-in about what the problems are that we should be trying to solve and how much change we should be introducing. So that means, to me, less detail in terms of building out the fully working model, although get enough of it to give some sense of what's involved.
Sure. Okay. Lily? Well,
just a quick observation. Peter, I look to you to jump in, but my only thought in response to Mary's comment was that the less detail that we have in the DP, the bigger the gap is going to be when we get to the ED phase.
But I think what we do have to, and one of our objectives in saying DP in July was to be able to put forward both the learning points that we had from all the work we did on Headroom, mm-hmm. and a full enough recap of it that if we have a very different reaction than we have been anticipating, we get the information in a structured way. So I'm not trying to say exclude that stuff, but I think once we have a direction, mm-hmm. yes, there'll be more of a gap in terms of how much work we have to do. But right now, it's like we're trying to move forward 5 alternative projects.
Mm, okay. Yeah.
I was just looking down the list that's in the question on pages 10 and 11 and sort of thinking again about what you'd need to have for a DP. And it seems to me, the question on guidance on differences between fair value and use, between value and use and fair value less cost of disposal, we probably don't need to do a lot more work for that for DP. I mean, I think we need to bring something to you in a paper probably, but I don't think we'd need to do a lot of work on that to have a sensible discussion in a DP. On the points in B, I think part of that is tied into the fact that we know one of the National Standards Centre is doing some work. The question is, do we want to see what comes out of that or not? That was, I think, one of the drivers behind B. And I think on 3 and 4, I think that's a question for the board where we've suggested that you look to that in one context. It would be worth thinking about whether your conclusion still applies given the somewhat changed objectives. Again, I don't think we see that as a lot more work. Probably it doesn't necessarily mean it would be a short paper that would come back to you, because it would need to bring back the information you'd need. But I don't think it would take a lot of development time necessarily to bring that back. On amortization, I think it probably would be a good idea to get some more input from the outside there, because I think all the board has done so far is put amortization back on the table. I think the board needs to have something new to inject into the debate, not just go back and ask people what their existing preferences are. So I think we need to bring something new to the table there. So I think that probably is quite important. On what the carrying amount of goodwill is used for, I mean, that's something that came out of the discussion at the last couple of board meetings, really. Whether we need to do that before the DP is probably slightly more questionable, or we could do that during the outreach phase, maybe, of the DP. And the disclosure ED, the question in E is something that we've sort of talked about in very general terms at the board table. I don't think we've really had a focused specific discussion on that, so we probably need some more discussion on that. Whether we need a lot of work for it, again, I suspect it probably doesn't need a lot of work. I'm looking at Tim and Wong Yi now, but doesn't seem to me like that's probably a big piece.
It would be just Zone E. It would be just whether we should have some more outreach just to get some feedback on those proposals, from the likes of our consultative groups. And it's just maybe I might just add a couple of other points just on the timeline and where the H1 2020 came from. And it is a high-level plan at this moment, mainly because it is subject to the discussion that we're having today and the further work that the board does recommend that we do. But it was largely around the need for some of that work, and amortisation, as Peter has explained, is a good example of that. But it's not out of the question that the outreach and the consultation that we're doing at the moment on disclosure with GPF and CMAC, we'll talk about that in paper 18B in a moment, but we're going to those meetings in November. It's not out of the question that from that feedback we need to do some more reconsideration and get some further feedback on what we develop.
That I understand, because that has not been fully developed
and that is an area where we do need to come back to the board with our ideas on, and so it was really the 2020 date was coming off the back of the next set of consultative group meetings in March and April, and on that basis we will be coming back to the board in May, let's just say, for argument's sake. Therefore we would be potentially starting to draft in June. And then it was looking at that drafting process. And so the initial thought was that would take us into early 2020. Now, following this meeting, next week, the team are getting together and we will do a planning session to work out, based on what we've heard today, how do we plan further work? But one of the things that we will consider is obviously how we plan the DP drafting. And there are elements of that DP drafting exercise that could be made more efficient. The DP itself lends itself to, actually, there are certain sections of it that can be drafted in parallel because they're relatively standalone sections. There is obviously an element where you then have to pull all the threads together, but there are sections of that can be drafted in tandem by different members of the team. And so that's an area that we can obviously explore. And there are obviously also certain sections that potentially can be started earlier than other sections. So as we go into the planning next week, we'll think about that. Just on Mary's comment on simplification, I do take the point, the objective that the board was setting was those targeted changes to value and use in the impairment test, which people do see or can see that as a simplification. And I think some of the feedback that we then received from ASAF and actually some of the thoughts that the staff had, coming out of the July meeting and thinking about those targeted changes and the focus that the board had shifted away from trying to improve the effectiveness of the impairment test, but recognising some of the cost to preparers, etc. There is the potential, and some of the feedback that we've had from the recent meeting at ASAF is that some of those members had suggested that we look at further simplification, go further than what is currently on the table in terms of those targeted improvements in value and use. And that's what we're sort of putting in front of you in paper 18A. Depending on the extent of work, if any, that you ask us to do on that topic, that could be quite extensive. And that's something that needs to be taken into account when you think about that, given the feedback that we've had on the timeline as well, because that would obviously impact that.
I think if I had to write a discussion paper on such a complex issue where with many different threads, I think I would start out by writing the document. And because only when writing things down and thinking about it very thoroughly, it will become more clear to you what is the additional information I need. How does it all hang together? Could
could be present two variations, and then only later when you have more clarity yourself. The outside world is not going to give you any solutions,
yeah,
because everybody's confused about, yeah, this. So I think only when you have pretty much clear for yourself what the way forward could be, then talk to our constituents and our consultative groups, because then you can ask much more pointed questions. This is what we're still struggling with. Can you help us? If you just go too early, it will just confuse you further. And so I would start out by trying to write a DP in the next couple of months and then go out. Mm. Anne?
I think we've got two streams of things happening, and someone's mentioned this, it might have been Mary, about we've got the performance, the acquisition performance, and then we've got this other big thing about goodwill. And the reason amortization came back onto the table was because of concerns that have been expressed about goodwill, and Gary's articulated today about this idea that goodwill exists forever, and some people just reject that. So I am pleased that Peter says, you know, if we're bringing amortization back into discussion, we have to bring something new to the table. So, you know, we can't just go with this is what we know. We have to come with some sort of new idea regarding how amortization is relevant to this issue of goodwill. Do we think that at ASAF we've been challenged with the question, do we think goodwill balances are a problem? Is that what we think the standards, you know, we need this standard setting because we think there's something wrong with these big goodwill balances? So as we think about the two areas and as we think about goodwill, with amortization has come up because we're thinking about the problem of goodwill. So if we are going to start talking to constituents about amortization, I think we have to have something new.
Well, the new thing, I mean, why did it come back was that our discussions about the headroom approach made it more clear, at least for me and I think also for others, that it might be a bit of a problem.
Yes.
So that is the new angle to the discussion, I think.
And do we need then to be able to talk about what we think the response to that is?
Well, yeah, well, the idea was to present amortization as a simplification of impairment, which is also a new angle. Mm-hmm. I also think you can, what I would certainly discuss in the discussion paper, if we were to go to bring this back, shouldn't we just have a fixed amortization period for because there's no way that anybody can estimate reliably what an amortization period would be. This is a simplification, so we're not trying to be. So there's plenty of stuff that you can bring to the table that would be new.
Yeah, and then that is what Gary's mentioned some minutes ago, where it all goes together. It's not just about the impairment. It's not just about the amortization. There'll be a discussion where we decide which could help, which path would be helpful given all the estimation that's going on and the problems that we've identified.
Mary?
I think what we need to consult about is what route we are taking. And I'm concerned that with the staff, the reason I'm not supportive of a number of the staff proposals is that they are about building a model to support a particular route, rather than reconsidering what are the reasons for and the costs and benefits of going different routes. So, you know, Anne was saying we need to bring something new to the table, you know, about goodwill and goodwill amortization. I think that's the context in which we're considering it, what problems we think it would solve, what the usefulness of the information. And I think we have that data already. I think it's not the things in paragraph 22. I think the things in paragraph 22 we have to enumerate as questions that would have to be answered if we were to go down that route. But I don't think we should spend 3 or 4 months deliberating and building out a model that we may or may not use. You know, and I'm being more absolute because I think you do have to give people some idea of how you might operationalize it. But I disagree with the idea that we should spend the time consulting with other groups, bringing the feedback back to the board, and then deliberating what this alternative model would look like before we can, you know, consult and call the question on whether or not we should go forward. And then when I look at a couple of the other things that Peter went through, I this is trying to be disciplined rather than having strong views about the specific issues. In question 1B, items 3 and 4, we made decisions on these points already. The fact that we dropped the headroom approach, I think these were complementary to the headroom approach rather than, you know, interactive with it. So I don't see why we say, because we changed one thing over here, we're going to go back and redo our deliberations on those two. I mean, maybe there may be other things that are driving the staff to say that, but based on what I've heard so far, there's not a new context that makes us have to spend the time redoing something. And I think it's the same thing about the value and use calculations, the two decisions we made. We don't need to reaffirm those. We've reached that conclusion. So I want us to be disciplined so that we can move forward. And the other thing is, if the, you know, what you head up in B about further simplifications of the impairment test, if that's something we didn't decide, you know, that was not one of our objectives in July, and based on subsequent consultations with ASAP, I think in terms of making this project run forward, it would be better to come and say specifically, we've had this feedback, we'd like the board to adopt a further objective of further simplifications, and here are the things we could do to it, because it takes a while to piece together from the papers that you're actually suggesting adding another objective to the list of problems we're trying to solve. And I think we have that's the kind of discussion we have to consult about in the DP. Should we have three objectives or two? You know.
Martin.
Yeah, man. On the same page, man. What Anne asked, what is really new and why we're doing this DP, man? My understanding was, okay, we had a post-implementation review. There was identified a problem that the impairment test is maybe not effective. Then we tried to work on that for several years to try to solve it. We were not successful, but we are concerned because if that is not effective, we have big amounts on the balance sheet. Alternatively, if the impairment test is not working, there are different methods how you can solve this problem. One is amortization. In addition, I think what we learned about, okay, is that investors are not really interested in goodwill. They are interested, is an acquisition successful, yes or no? Therefore, I think we decided, okay, maybe we look at disclosure. And in the past, we had linked this information about successful of an acquisition with a goodwill, impairment amortization, which I think we have learned investors doesn't care about. They want to have a disclosure. So what is new, I think the argument against goodwill amortization was always, okay, there is not any information value in it. But if investors, also with the impairment model, think it is not any information value in it, who cares about this? Therefore, I think we said, okay, let's look at improving disclosures to make investors happy, and then asking really our constituents, okay, if we have not, after several years, found okay to make impairment tests more effective, would it be maybe a good idea for simplification to go back to amortization? I think that is, for me, the core of the DP, mm-hmm. and not if we have further simplification methods and can do anything that is all interesting, but it's not what we're looking for guidance. And my understanding that what we decided in July was to ask for this kind of question.
Nick?
Again, building on what Anne said and partly on what Martin said, I think it's important to remember that goodwill is an accounting construction. The obsession that we see today around goodwill is not reflected by market participants, either investors or companies. We're trying to find an accounting solution for this issue. I don't think the issue of goodwill is going to go away either. The more unrecognized intangibles that appear in companies will provide some protection to that goodwill number as well, as the impairment test is currently constructed. So it's not going to go away. It's going to remain an issue. But it's really, so perhaps that's why I'm not sure the question is just about amortization. I think it's about providing either relief or useful information for market participants and not become overly obsessed just with this goodwill number. Mm. It's not something the outside world, they simply don't share the same level of interest in it. It's not to say they're not doing their jobs. Companies will look at potential acquisitions in terms of thinking about future cash flows. Investors will think of them in very similar ways also. It's an accounting issue.
Gary?
Thank you. Thinking about all of this and this morning's discussion, and I actually don't know how much true outreach we need to do. I think most of the information that we would put in a document, the information's already here, or it's relatively straightforward. We could, you know, use our own intellectual capacity and write it. You know, so for example, I'm looking at paragraph 22. If we're reintroducing goodwill, well, the amortization method, what would you do? And it used to be straight line up to 40 years a long time ago.
In the U.S.
Yes, in the U.S. And I don't know where it was every place else, but 20? It's still a long time.
But
amortization method, I mean, let's say you wanted to bring something new to the table, have a fresh discussion. Well, maybe the amortization method is tied more like how you amortize identifiable intangibles, and you sort of, the amortization method is tied to what value you're trying to buy, the life of the workforce, the life of the patents, the life of the customers. I mean, that's a new discussion. And the answers might be different depending by company or by industry, or the value of your technology software, you know, but they all got finite lives. Workforces turn over every 15 years or something like that. Patents expire. And maybe you tie it, the amortization, more to something like that. And again, it could vary by company, which it is. That's a very different approach than just an arbitrary straight line, 20 years, 30, 40 years, whatever. That's something new. I think we've also been talking in binary extremes, is should we test impairment at the CGU level, which imminently makes sense, or should we test at the segment or the enterprise level, which arguably is good too. Maybe the discussion is, you assume it starts off the CGU, but what factors should come into place where you elevate it up, you know, the food chain, where you test at a higher level. Maybe that's the meaningful input you need to get, especially for integrated acquisitions. I mean, they morph, they dissipate. You know, that would say the CGU goes away, or at least the CGU itself, no pun intended, gets impaired as a standalone entity. It loses its unit of account identity. So therefore, when do you earn the right to elevate to a higher level of goodwill? That's a different discussion. I don't think we've had that, at least not in my presence. But all that being said, I don't know, those are possibilities that are, I don't know that we need a lot more outside consulting to learn how to write. I think we know what we can write. Then you go out and test it.
Well, I'm not sure if we should vote on the question. I think the staff should just take away this discussion. And, I think the overall message was pretty clear. Okay. Then we go to paper 18B.
Yes,
thanks, Hans. Yes. In this paper, we'd like to ask the board to confirm the additional work to be performed in relation to identifying better disclosure for business combination, goodwill, and impairment. In July 2018 meeting, based on key findings from the research work, the board decided to pursue exploring whether disclosure could be improved to enable investors to assess more effectively whether business combination is a good investment decision and whether acquired business is performing as expected after the acquisition. A summary of the feedback from the July 2018 ASM meeting, where disclosure was discussed, is set out in paragraphs 13 to 23. And this feedback definitely will be incorporated into the staff's consideration of the possible improvements to disclosures. Paragraph 24 to 35 assess the further work that could be performed to identify better disclosure for business combinations and their subsequent performance. And
paragraph 36 to 39 extend this to consider the disclosure in IAS 36. As explained, paragraph 40, the staff will present at a future meeting the result of each additional work and each idea for possible improvement to the disclosure objectives and requirements of IFRS 3 and IAS 36. There are two questions to the board in this paper. So firstly, does the board have any comments on the additional work to be performed, especially the detailed in paragraph 29 to 30, 33 to 34, and 37. Secondly, does the board agree not to perform a full review of the disclosure objectives and requirements of IFRS 3 and IAS 36? Just for clarity, the distinction between doing a full review of IFRS 3 disclosure and what the staff are proposing to perform is, our proposal is to develop ideas for disclosure objective and requirements. Because, as explained, paragraph 29C and 35, our proposal is to develop the ideas to help meet the objective set by the board in July. This might involve some suggestions for reorganizing the existing disclosure to accommodate these changes, and also involve some suggestions of amendments to existing disclosure requirements to help this objective based on what we have already heard from the PIR of IFRS 3 and during our research project. On the other hand, a full leap would require additional outreach to understand what stakeholders want and why. And while we would expect the objective set by the board in July to be part of this, we think there may be more, and this would also involve starting from a blank piece of paper, redrafting the disclosure objectives and requirements for IFRS 3. So, welcome to any comment.
Just to clarify that, so actually we're not going to, you know, completely review all the disclosure objective and the requirements of IFRS 3, only based on the objective we discussed the July meeting, that is, you know, whether those disclosure can help users suggest whether that is a good investment or not.
Yes.
So based on this one.
Yes, right.
So this is exactly what paragraph 29.
Yes.
A said that staff intend to develop an additional disclosure objective. That additional disclosure objective is that paragraph 12 said that, or we needed to develop another objective, or based on paragraph 12?
Yeah. It's about the paragraph 12. The second part, whether the acquired business is performing after the combination as expected.
So this is actually not additional, just based on our July discussion.
Yes, right.
And the objective have been identified. Okay, thank you.
Mary.
I'll give my personal view on the second question, which is I agree with the staff recommendation that we do not start comprehensive standards level review of the disclosures. And I think really the improvements in the disclosure are to me the centerpiece of now what we're focusing on. And I think the big problem, the big challenge that we have to solve is what are operationally feasible disclosures that would deliver the objective of giving users post-acquisition information about the performance of the acquisition. And when I look at the list of things that is in the feedback from the ASAP meeting, so that's paragraph 13, some of the additional possible items, many of them strike me as probably nice to have, and I'm kind of looking in Nick's direction because I would very much want to take guidance from him. They're nice to haves, but they aren't central to the objective of what is the post-acquisition performance, so that you use disclosures to deliver the accountability for acquisitions. And I think there are some challenges. I am not convinced about the method that the staff has proposed for getting the information we need, which is basically talking only to preparers of financial statements about what they think is feasible to do. I think we should be talking to preparers about what's feasible, but I think we might need to think of ways and not use only our CMAQ and GPF because we're so constrained by the scheduling to try and see if we could almost do some kind of financial reporting lab type work to say, get small, you know, a couple of small groups of users and preparers and say, this is the information I need, what can you do, and have the kind of back and forth in real time that bottoms out some of that. I don't think it's the broader generic consultation, and I don't want it to be based solely on what a preparer thinks they'd be comfortable from a commercial sensitivity and ease of doing, because this is hard stuff where we're asking them to show things to the public that they maybe don't want to, both in terms of their business success and their accountability. Yeah. So I think that's a weakness in design in terms of information gathering.
Nick?
Thank you. Yeah, so just, I mean, I think it's important to differentiate. So looking at paragraph 13, which I think is the paragraph Mary referred to, I mean, I think not all of those disclosures relate to subsequent performance. Some about the terms of the transaction when it's initiated. So it is important to have think about those two groups separately. The subsequent performance is a challenge in that transactions are different. I think there's a lot of value in actually going out to both preparers and users, yes, as you say, and having that conversation. There's clearly some skepticism to a through the eyes of management approach, given people still have segment reporting very much in their mind and have frustrations about that. But I'm not sure there's a kind of necessary standard model you can have for every single transaction in all circumstances. And I think the final point to make is also that this information has a half-life. Many transactions are integrated within existing businesses, and I feel it's unrealistic to ask for a lengthy record of subsequent performance. You know, you have to realize this becomes part of a group and entity. But the substance of, you know, the substantive point in terms of consulting with both preparers and users, I imagine that's what was intended to happen on the subsequent performance.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to clarify a couple of points that Mary has made. The initial outreach to preparers was just to give us a little bit of targeted feedback on some of the ideas we were developing, such that when we then will take those proposals to GPF and to use the community at CMAQ, they're a little bit more sort of rounded and had that initial feedback. But that was only really just to help us come up with some initial ideas to take to those consultative groups. We are obviously going to preparers and users in those consultative groups, and then from the feedback that we get from those groups, then potentially, as Mary suggests, we might think about some sort of roundtable type discussions with preparers and with users to work those up. And the other point I was going to make was the feedback that's in this paper from the ASAF meeting back in July, I think. The disclosure proposals that we're now sort of working through and the ideas that we're now working on have developed further from that. And this meeting, I think, was before the board meeting. Yeah. And therefore, actually, we're now thinking much more about subsequent performance and how we might provide some ideas around that. And so the thinking has moved on. And part of what we will do in developing the ideas around disclosure is we will think about the feedback that we have received in various formats, you know, in the PIR, from that ASAF meeting and various other outreach that we've done, and look at little bits, the feedback that's relevant to the objectives that we've now set from a disclosure perspective.
Can I just comment on Mary's suggestion of a lab-style discussion? I really like that, and in general, I think that's something we should be trying to do more of. Just thinking through the timetable, I mean, the only established mechanism we have at the moment is the joint CMAQ GPF meeting, which isn't till June, which I think is probably longer than we want to to wait before we have that discussion. So I think we'd probably need to set up some ad hoc discussions, and they probably need to be a series of national discussions. It's probably quite difficult to set up a sort of international joint discussion, I suspect.
But Gary.
This whole project always been clear. I support disclosures of how an acquisitions are doing, and Nick is absolutely right. They got a finite life. This information is reasonably verifiably available. You know, so we're talking a couple of years max. You know, but I think here's a case, and kind of reflecting on where we are in the disclosure initiative, is if there's ever going to be a case for, I'll call it, objectives-based disclosures, this might be it. And I'm thinking, is you start off with a presumption the enterprise has got a total set of results, and some of it's from the existing businesses and some of the acquired business, and the management has to talk about them. If you puff up the acquisition too strongly, well, the other message is the existing business is doing poorly. And likewise, if you say the existing business is doing great, that implies the acquisition is not doing so well. So I think there's a bit of checks and balances for truth and communications within some tolerable limits in the system. Not to say it's infallible, but I think that should be a going premise. But as far as how the acquisition is doing, I think companies treat information differently, they track it differently, and there's degrees of commercial sensitivity. But if you posited a list that you will make disclosures about how an acquisition is financially doing, it could be from one of the following. You know, I'll just go through this. You could disclose the absolute amounts of revenue and expense and profit. You could say instead disclose its incremental contributions to the organization, which is somewhat different because that starts when the synergies start coming into play. If it's its own segment or substantially all of a segment, the segment reporting becomes the information vehicle. You could disclose how is its results doing against the acquisition's assumptions that we gave you when you approved the acquisition. I think these are all different ways of communicating how well is it doing. Different companies will report it differently, but nonetheless, you know, for the analysts, they'll get a sense of how management thinks the acquisition is performing for them. So maybe it won't be perfect comparability because someone might do absolute numbers. Someone will say, well, it's 95% of the segment, therefore just look at the segment information and so on. But I think we have to think in those terms to be specific about a way what you must do will get very difficult because companies, they treat acquisitions differently between breaking them up and the way they keep information and so on. And you will have to also deal with it, you know, when you've got an acquiree and the parent, when there some new business is acquired that neither one could get on their own, but together they can, how do you apportion that in here? And that might get to be a management approach. I assure you, they might do it different ways, but material acquisitions, companies measure internally how they are doing again, but they're probably measuring against how the company evaluates its internal operations anyways, not necessarily that we would look at it or a professional analyst would, but big acquisitions. There is a measures that exist internally. It just might not be verifiable. It might sort of vary with the personalities, the executives doing it, but they do measure these things.
I suppose.
But I was thinking very much along the lines that Gary has just explained. First of all, I agree with what you proposed to restart from the objectives and do some work, and I also agree with what Mary has said, that is the centerpiece in a way of the work to be done. Where I think somewhat along the lines that Gary has explained is that I think we should move away from the idea that we're going to measure exactly what is the performance of that acquired business, because we're not going to get away with the difficulty. And the difficulty is real because depending on the circumstances, of course, but basically the integration process is underway. So when we have the two objectives of first providing users with the information of why this acquisition makes sense, what is expected from it, I think what comes immediately thereafter is how are the success of this acquisition being measured? What are the key measures of that success? And I agree with Gary that they exist. They should be disclosed at that time. And in fact, the meeting the second objective would be largely based on those key measures of success that are directly stemming from the facts and circumstances of the acquisition. And I think if we go that route, it may be more entity-specific in a way, but I think it will come to something that will not be stopped because it's not feasible. By definition, it's feasible because it fits the circumstances of that particular acquisition. And it may vary greatly, I agree with that also, from one acquisition to the next.
Chang-woo.
Thank you. I generally agree with the step recommendation directions. We need to get more feedback how this specific disclosure information is being used by analysts and investors. But one specific question to Nick, but just curiosity, if you see the paragraph 4 here, investors would like to have some information, about the key drivers that justify the consideration paid for business combination, and hence the amount of good deal, and whether the acquisition has been successful. So the first idea is still investors would like to know some amount of a good deal. That's one thing. Based on this kind of the information of key drivers and whether the acquisition is successful or not. Another thing, if we provide some information, for example, revenue or operating profit for one acquisition by another acquisition, how those numbers are incorporated in your, for example, some valuation equation. So this kind of thing, little bit another topic there, our team will investigate, but for now, these 2 points, if you can help us, then.
Yeah. So I think the numbers will be used in at least a couple of different ways. I think for me, the primary use is thinking about the role of management in allocating capital. And we know that an awful lot of capital over the last few decades has been allocated to M&A. So are these transactions that are delivering value? And it's as much as me perhaps to look at a historic transaction to then think about the next transaction and the next transaction after that. I want to take a reading on it. So in that respect, I'm not terribly interested in the goodwill component. I'm interested in what I call the economics of the deal. What is the total consideration, including the acquired debt, including any cost of restructuring, and what is the likely return on that consideration over the medium term? Don't expect that all to come on day one, but so then I want to start to build in any synergies that I would believe, whether they be through working capital, revenue, costs, and so on. And in that respect, that's the information that I'm initially looking at. Is this going to generate a reasonable return on investment for me or for the shareholders, for the ultimate owners, over time? The second thing that people may want to do with this is to be more, precise in building out their models. And that will depend upon the size of the acquisition again. And so there's some information there. But primarily for me and for a lot of investors, it's really about, are these transactions likely to deliver good value? We know there's a lot of academic evidence that says many transactions don't deliver value to shareholders. So shareholders come with a degree of skepticism to this. Almost as a forward-looking indicator in terms of, actually, it's not so much about this one, but the next one and the one after that and the one after that. Fabulous if I can find a management team that consistently deliver value from acquisitions and reinvest cash flow into those. I'm very happy to back them on that basis at the right price.
We've had feedback along the way that preparers think the disclosures are already excessive. This is stated in paragraph 5. And in various fora, we've been told that it'll be difficult to get this information about the success of the acquisition. But we've also heard that some people have got the view that it can be accessed through the segment notes. So I'm pleased that in the paper there's a couple of references to IFRS 8, and there are just some feedback that we've received that the information that the analysts are looking for can come, we can use segments. Gary's referred to that being a place that some preparers do provide this information that the analysts can then use. So I just encourage the staff to not think about providing this information only through mandating additional disclosures, but thinking about how, in the mechanisms we already have, how this information could be added in and therefore satisfy the demand from users for the information, making use of ways that preparers are already going towards providing it.
Mary.
A general observation with a couple of examples. I think we always, we're standard setters, so when somebody brings us a problem, we start doing standard setting. Sometimes the problems that people are bringing, we should recognize as being compliance issues and not do more standard setting. And there's one place in the paper that says, well, we already have a requirement and nobody does it, so we should probably just drop the requirement. And I think we probably should be saying first, is this a compliance issue? And if we got, if we started highlighting this and talking with auditors, regulators, the two lines of defense on enforcement, would we be getting better information to users, or is it unnecessary? And second, another example is the point about how users want information about amortization of intangibles. I think we've been through before in a discussion at the board that said the existing requirements in IAS 38 for reconciliation of changes in carrying value of intangibles by class should be producing the information that users want about amortization of intangibles that are recognized by all entities versus amortization of intangibles that are recognized only in a business combination and intangibles that are not recognized. So, we don't have to do standard setting. We have to remind people that we have a requirement that should be delivering the information that users want. And, maybe we have to help preparers understand that users really want that information. And there's another point in the paper about people want all of the information, what's the total all-in cost of the acquisition, and should we be doing research in that area? Looking quickly at the requirements of IFRS 3, it seems to enumerate all of the components of cost of a transaction. So if we think it doesn't work in eliciting that, I think we have to ask the question first, is it compliance, or is it bringing greater clarity to what we have here? Because it seems perfectly reasonable to me that somebody should say, here's the total of what I paid, composed of cash, shares, fees, transactions. Here is what I recognize, for what I paid, and having that in one place pulled together. But I don't know that it's standard setting because the requirements seem to be here. So as we approach this project, and this is kind of to Anne's point about we hear about disclosure overload, let's just not add more. Let's first assess where we think it's poor understanding of requirements. Maybe we can improve the drafting, or whether it's just compliance issues.
Just to respond to those points from Mary, I very much like the staff suggestion in the paper of actually separating out through disaggregation the amortization of other intangibles on the face. I think that'd be very helpful. It is often the number one thing that users struggle with to find and to separate, and the fact worse than that, companies in some of their non-GAAP reconciliation or non-GAAP numbers are choosing to add back the whole of the amortization charge. Just because now, whether that's compliance or regulation, I think just ease of finding the information, which is an important piece of information.
But you're saying then it's prominence, not creating the.
On the second issue, which is now I've now lost.
Total cost.
So I've explored this in a practical sense for many years, as has Krupp, and there's sufficient latitude in the requirements of the standard at the moment of the words to allow you, because it talks about disclosure of major categories of assets and liabilities, and that allows for an undue level of aggregation. So you can have long-term liabilities without splitting out the financial liabilities from the other liabilities. That is what we see. So whether it's about, again, compliance and regulation or slightly tightening the words, I'm not sure, but I'm just telling you the practical experience. And this discussion about whether the standard delivers or not has been going on for 10 years plus on this particular aspect.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily more. It's just bringing greater clarity to what's there.
Precision, yeah. Yes.
Small point, but I think it's important. As we go forward, could we please clarify what we mean by good investment? I suspect you mean it's profitable or the returns are positive or something, but we need to be very specific what we mean.
Okay. Do we need a vote?
Second question,
So do we agree with the staff proposal in the second question?
Oh, I'm sorry, 13, one absent.
And the final paper, Tim?
Yes. Paper 18C. So this paper provides an outline of the possible structure of the discussion paper. There's no questions for the board in the paper. The staff would welcome any overall comments board members may have. And I'm also happy to take more detailed comments offline if that's more appropriate.
I'm just going back to what I said before and thinking about our experience, with FICE. If we could, right now we go through background, the research performed, the PIR, what we considered first, what we rejected. So you have to read to the end to find out where we are. I think a lot of that can be, if you think about how a software works, if you want more information about this, click here to go back. I think we want to put really front and center, we're trying to decide what to do. Here's what our objectives are. Do you agree with the objectives? Here's the things that we would do to operationalize those objectives. We may not have worked it out in full. Do you think these will be successful? And have we considered the costs and challenges of those? And then you can read this to see what we thought about and didn't decide to do and why we didn't. You can read this there, because the whole build up to where we are taking everybody on our journey, that they'll lose the will to live before they get to the point where they give responses.
Good point.
Joe? Yes, 2 points. One is about the paragraph 11 about the disclosure improvement, because we have just discussed the disclosure improvements. I think the decision we made is specifically those improvements related to the goodwill, not fully review IFRS 3 disclosure. But the word here said that paragraph 11, second sentence, says details of a full review of IFRS 3 disclosure. I think the scope is too broad. And the second point is with regard to the reintroduction of amortization goodwill. I think when we drafted this portion of the content, I think we still should mention that even reintroduce amortization goodwill, the entity still needed to do impairment tests for those amortized goodwill. So it's also relevant to the cost and whether also relevant to providing useful information to the user, something like that, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.